What transforms a South Bronx street kid into one of cinema's most iconic figures? The answer isn't what you'd expect. Al Pacino's journey didn't follow some ordained path to greatness. It was messy, chaotic, and often felt like pure survival. Picture a teenager bellowing Shakespeare into empty factory districts at 3 a.m., training himself on Hamlet soliloquies because he couldn't afford acting classes. That raw hunger, that refusal to wait for permission, became the foundation of an extraordinary career. Pacino's story reveals something essential about artistry. It doesn't emerge from privilege or careful planning, but from an almost reckless devotion to something larger than yourself. Even Martin Scorsese recognized this quality, noting that Pacino doesn't merely perform, he channels something deeper, inhabiting souls rather than playing parts. This memoir strips away the Hollywood mythology to reveal the man behind Michael Corleone and Tony Montana, showing us that genius often wears the disguise of desperation. Life in the South Bronx meant navigating daily danger and wonder. Pacino's childhood gang included Cliffy, the fearless leader who read Dostoevsky between street fights, and Jaime, whose special needs made him the gang's protector through sheer strength. They'd taunt police, walk five-story rooftop ledges, and explore the notorious Dutchies, a dangerous area where wayward kids fashioned homemade weapons. This wasn't romanticized poverty. It was real, with fatal consequences. Pacino lived in two worlds, the street gang and his pal baseball team, which offered structure and normalcy. When someone stole his baseball glove at knife point, the incident crystallized his vulnerability outside the gang's protection. His mother's strict rules keeping him from late-night adventures felt oppressive then, but decades later, he understood. She'd saved his life. Petey, Cliffy, and Bruce all eventually succumbed to heroin, their potential extinguished by the streets that had once felt like freedom. The lesson embedded itself deep. Sometimes the people who frustrate us most are actually our lifelines. At 15, Pacino discovered Chekhov's The Seagull at the nearly empty Ellesmere Theater. Though he barely grasped all the themes, it struck him like a lightning bolt. He carried Chekhov's books everywhere, finding characters who mirrored his struggle with meaning and identity. These Russian outsiders felt like family to a Bronx kid who never fit in. His acceptance into the High School of Performing Arts brought unexpected disappointment. Selected to represent the school in a newspaper article, he was replaced with a more mainstream-looking student. The rejection clarified something essential. He would never be the conventional choice. When his mother's breakdown required expensive treatments, he quit school at 16 to work. Remarkably, he felt ecstatic. This ability to find freedom in apparent failure became his defining strength. His mentor, Charlie Lawton, became the father figure he'd lacked, sharing wisdom like the Flying Willenda story, life's on the wire, the rest is just waiting. When his grandfather later arranged a construction job, Pacino called the morning he was supposed to start. His grandfather simply said, "You're not going to work, I know, that's okay." That unconditional acceptance gave him permission to pursue an impossible dream. Greenwich Village became Pacino's university. He cleaned toilets at the Living Theater, worked as a superintendent, and performed 16 shows weekly at Cafe Sino, passing the hat for meal money. Living in an $8 a week Chelsea rooming house, sometimes homeless and always hungry, he survived through a community of artists who chose art over security. He spent hours in libraries for warmth, nursing single coffees at automats while reading Hemingway, thinking, "I don't want to finish the pages. I like it here too much." During Strindberg's Creditors at a Soho gallery, something profound occurred. Pacino felt himself transcending, speaking Strindberg's words as if they were his own, a door opened to the living spirit of energy. This wasn't ambition, but recognition of purpose. His breakthrough came with The Indian Wants the Bronx, playing Murph, an unpredictable street tough channeling his old crew. After humiliatingly re-auditioning for his own role, his passionate performance won it back. Clive Barnes's enthusiastic New York Times review changed everything overnight. Francis Ford Coppola first reached out after seeing Pacino in Does a Tiger Wear a Necktie on Broadway. Despite his fear of flying, Pacino traveled to San Francisco for 5 days discussing a script, encountering young filmmakers, George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, Martin Scorsese, Brian De Palma, though he didn't recognize them then. When that project fell through, he assumed he'd never hear from Coppola again. Then came the call offering him Michael Corleone. The Godfather's transcendence came from portraying universal family dynamics combined with Brando's iconic performance as someone who could protect the vulnerable. Fame hit immediately and brutally. A woman kissed his hand on the street, calling him Godfather. His precious anonymity evaporated overnight. Before The Godfather, he'd only seen himself in a newspaper once. He was still working as a building superintendent, not long past homelessness. As Heathcote Williams observed, fame is the perversion of the natural human instinct for validation. Instead of shining light on characters, all lights were now on Pacino, and he couldn't see out. His reaction was to distance himself from the success, convincing himself Coppola was the miracle who made that movie. When Mario Puzo showed Pacino The Godfather Part II's first draft, he called it crap. Paramount offered escalating sums, $100,000, $200,000, even $1 million in cash. Money wasn't the issue. The script wasn't ready. When Coppola joined, they worked 6 intense days in San Francisco, creating Hyman Roth as Michael's new rival. Charlie suggested Lee Strasberg, Pacino's former teacher. Working with his acting mentor added an audible dimension. Roth became a father figure Michael would ultimately kill. Paul Muni's 1932 Scarface deeply inspired Pacino. Their version wasn't about Depression-era scarcity, but Reagan-era abundance. Everything available, yet somehow unreachable. Pacino loved Tony Montana's two-dimensional nature. What you see is what you get, and fuck you. The film initially flopped. People walked out. Only Eddie Murphy appreciated it. Yet the hip-hop generation embraced Tony Montana's mythology, recognizing it as a parable about viewing life as cheap. The film became counterculture, spreading worldwide. The lesson? Work that feels most authentic often gets rejected initially, but if genuine, it eventually finds its audience. After commercial failures, Pacino quit films for avant-garde theater. During this retreat, he discovered he was broke. Only $90,000 remained. Diane Keaton confronted his lawyer and pushed him back to work. With her encouragement, he made Sea of Love, a $100 million hit that revitalized his career. When he won his Oscar in 1993 after 7 losses, he began, "Well, you broke my streak." He thanked mentors like Strasberg and Lawton, then was whisked to a jet for Carlito's Way filming. Alone with his statue, he felt profound accomplishment. Looking back, Pacino cherishes his South Bronx childhood. Their block was its own universe under the L train. He survived while childhood friends didn't, perhaps because his mother called him home, or he met Charlie, or discovered Shakespeare. As Charlie told him near the end, "You're a miracle, Al." His whole life was a moonshot, improbable, impossible, yet real. The streets that could have destroyed him instead forged something unbreakable, an artist who never forgot where he came from, who never stopped believing the work itself was the reward.